Since 2005, David Letterman has been followed each weekday night by Craig Ferguson on The Late Late Show. Until he became the unlikely host of the show, this Scottish actor, writer, and comic was best known in the U.S. for his starring role in the comedy The Big Tease, which he also wrote, and for playing the boss on The Drew Carey Show. Now he's written his first novel. It's called Between the Bridge and the River. Two of the main characters, Saul and Leon, are half-brothers, the love children of Frank Sinatra and Peter Lawford. They start their own church, but first they take a road trip through the American South.
For most of the way, Route 40 follows old Route 66, a highway white America remembers fondly because for them it conjures up a time of innocence before cigarettes gave people cancer and gasoline fumes burned a hole in the sky, a time before homosexuality and drugs, a time when the only threats to the world were Soviet Russia, aggressive extraterrestrials, or perhaps the occasional mutant insect that had inadvertently fallen into a nuclear reactor and grown to 5,000 times its original size and was intent on eating Chicago. In short, Route 66 was a symbol of what white America is really nostalgic for, a time that never existed. Saul and Leon were, of course, white American. They used history, their countries and their own, and any suitable religious doctrine to suit their own ends. They were survivors, like roaches. Saul and Leon were barkers at the carnival tent catering to the low-income end of America's spiritually disenfranchised. Historically, it is better for religions to cater to the poor because there is always more of them. They are more desperate, so therefore they will cough up as much money and devotion as they can. Plus, their life on Earth is unpleasant enough for them to buy the idea that things might actually improve after death.
Craig Ferguson reading from Between the Bridge and the River, his first novel. Writing a book was new to him, but he spent a lot of time writing his monologues for The Late Late Show, which aren't always about the day's events. Perhaps your most talked about monologue was the one that you did after your father died. And I'm wondering how you decided to do that, how you decided to actually mention it, and not only to mention it, but to really talk about him for a while. And it wasn't, there was funny stuff in it, but it wasn't meant to, like, crack up the audience. I mean, it was a pretty reflective monologue.
Yeah, the thing about the monologue is most nights I understand that my job is to keep it light and to entertain, but I tell the truth on that show. I made a decision I went through a divorce a couple of years ago, and I realized that, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'd made, I think I'd made like two movies I liked and everything, and a couple of episodes of the Drew Carey show that I'd been on I liked, and everything else I'd done I thought was junk. And I thought, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to do exactly what I want. So I'm going to write a book that I want to write. I'm going to do a show that I want to do. So when it came to, you know, my father's passing, I had the option was I could either not do a show or ignore it and do a bunch of jokes about, I don't know, the weather or the playoffs or, you know, Paris Hilton. You know, I don't care for that. And there's plenty of other channels to get that on. You know, I do the show that I want to do, and if anyone wants to watch it, that's great. And I want them to watch it. It's not like I'm trying to exclude people. I want people to watch the show, but not at the expense of my own sanity or my own life. So, you know, I talk about my life in the show, and I'll talk about what happened in my life. And that's a big deal when a parent dies. I'm not gonna, you know. It was my dad. I loved him. I wanted to talk about him. And it seemed the appropriate thing to do. I called my mother first and asked her what she thought. And she said, yeah, do it. Do it. Do whatever you think's right.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in that monologue about your father is that when you were in rehab to give up drinking, you said your father came to visit you and he said, well, Craig, I'm not going to stop drinking.
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I thought that was a really funny moment. And I couldn't help but wonder, what did you think at that moment when he said it to you?
I think at that point, it's hard to recall. When I was in rehab, it was 14 years ago. And I understandably, my brains were a little fried at the time. I do remember thinking it was funny. And I do. The main thing I remember is that my parents had to cross, you know, the entire United Kingdom. I was in rehab in southern England, and they crossed the country to come and visit me in this, you know, kind of rather swanky, I think, treatment center. I mean, I was in on credit; I had no money, but they came to this very alien environment, and I was kind of touched by it. They didn't understand it. They didn't really understand what was going on with me. But they knew that I was in trouble. I knew I was in trouble. And I think that, you know, that was just, it was my dad. He was kind of uncompromising. There was something reassuring about it, actually, I suppose. I think I remember thinking that. I didn't want my dad to give up drinking and start giving me hugs and talking about his inner child. That would have made me very uncomfortable.
How did you know you were in trouble?
Oh, I think there was some evidence, you know, the way that drinking manifested itself for me, I couldn't tell you with any degree of certainty what was going to happen if I had a drink. I might go out and have a drink and be very nice and come home, you know, a couple of hours later. I might go out with that intention to do that and wake up 4 days later in another country. So it was a very random and weird experience, the drinking. But I've been, I guess it's over 14 years now since I had a drink. So I probably have been off the stuff as long as I was on it.
Would you describe where you grew up in Scotland?
Yeah, where I grew up in Scotland was a town called Cumbernauld, which is about 15 miles outside the big industrial city of Glasgow. Glasgow was heavily bombed during the Second World War, so Cumbernauld, although it was a tiny village and dates back to Roman times, the village itself, it's a big, sprawling new town. It was built very quickly in the late 50s, early 60s and 70s. They built houses upon houses upon houses upon houses, and there weren't a lot of facilities other than houses. And a lot of the people that moved there were coming from Glasgow. They were misplaced. They were a little anxious to be there. It was a rough place. It was a rough town. I think it was voted even recently the second worst place in Britain to live.
Did it feel like a bad place to you?
I wasn't aware of it feeling that bad. It doesn't even feel like a bad place to me now. What it was I realise looking back on it now, was the constant threat of violence was what I found intimidating. Now, the other people who have grown up there will tell you that that's not true, and maybe that's not true for them, but I felt, you know, especially as a young man, you're a target for other young men, and there was a lot of sectarian violence, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of drinking, you know, outside. My home was actually a kind of a haven, but outside the home, it was terrible, and the schools were terrible, to my mind. I didn't find the schools in any way, I only went to one, but the school that I went to was, corporal punishment was still in place. It was outlawed in Scotland in 1979 by the European Court of Human Rights, which was a problem for me because I left school in 1978. So the teachers were state-endorsed bullies. You know, they would hit you, they would hurt you.
Well, you quit school when you were 15 or 16?
Yeah, I did. I walked out on it. I didn't like it.
So when you quit, what did you do?
I drank mostly for a while. I drank and I was a drummer in punk rock bands, which punk rock was very kind of popular at the time. And I had this ratty old drum kit and I made a living playing it. I wasn't a bad drummer, so I would kind of be a jobbing drummer for punk rock bands. It's in a punk rock band, in rock and roll, it's very important that someone can actually keep the time while everybody else goes nuts. That's what I did, and I kind of worked in bars and I bussed around, and I worked as a bar. The reason I actually get into show business is I worked in a bar next to a theatre, and I was the bartender there, and the guy that used to come in that used to run the theatre, who's now the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. But he came in, his name's Michael Boyd, and he said, you know, he would talk to me, and I was behind the bar, and you're kind of on show when you're a bartender in a busy bar. And I kind of became a pet to these actors, you know, and they kind of invited me into the theatre, and I kind of drifted in that way.
And you found you liked it?
I did like it. I liked show business because it seemed to be very forgiving of drunkenness. And also, you know, you could work while you were drunk. And there were a lot of very attractive girls who also were much friendlier than any girls I'd met before.
Well, you're making it seem that it was lucky you were drunk. Otherwise, you never would have gotten into show business.
Oh, I don't for a second discount alcohol. I'm not a temperance campaigner in any way, shape or form. I'm quite clear on alcohol saved my life at times. You know, it was the medication which... which I was trying to even out, I think, a lot of the time with alcohol. I think if I could drink alcohol, I would drink it. I am not in any way, shape or form anti-alcohol. I'm anti the way I drank it.
My guest is Craig Ferguson, host of The Late Late Show on CBS and author of the new novel Between the Bridge and the River. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Craig Ferguson. He hosts The Late Late Show after David Letterman on CBS, and he's just written his first novel called Between the Bridge and the River. So how did you get to the United States?
Well, it was a circuitous route. I mean, I came here in 1976 with my father, and so we came over to visit then, and it was 1976. I was 13, and, you know, America was going through the bicentennial, so it was a very exciting time to be here. And also, I was at a very impressionable age. And I loved America. I loved America before because it was the source of all glamour. You know, superheroes, cowboys, rock and roll, everything came from America. So to actually get to America from Scotland at that time, I at that point swore I would come back. And then I came back when I was 21 and lived in New York City for a while, for a year, working in a construction site in Harlem, and living in the East Village, which anyone will tell you is a bit of a commute. So I would work in this construction site during the day, and then there was a bar at that time called The Last Resort, which is now called Coyote Ugly in the East Village, which they made that movie about dancing about, which used to have this, what they called the American Modern Dance Theatre, which is a very grand name for a bunch of gay men that wore black clothing and, you know, danced around, and they invited me to join their happy band, and I did. And I was at that time I was married to a Scottish girl, and we were both, you know, we became the pets of this fabulous bunch of guys in the East Village. So I would dance with these guys in the evening and do construction during the day, which you don't need to go to the gym if you do that. But I was 21 then. I don't think I could do it anymore.
One of the movies that you co-wrote and co-starred in, well, you really starred in this one, The Big Tease. You play a gay character. He's a hairdresser from Scotland who wants to compete in the big haircutting competition in the United States, and he thinks he's invited, and when he gets to Los Angeles, he finds out he was actually invited to be in the audience, not to be in the competition, so then he has to figure out how to actually get into the competition. So,
Well, that's very much my life in LA. When I came to LA in 95, I thought I was invited, and I found out I was invited to be in the audience. I mean, I also wanted to use, I mean, the reason why, you know, it was set in the world of hairdressing is I wanted to use a business that took itself very seriously, that doesn't really matter that much. And that's why I chose, you know, the hairdressing as an allegory for show business. It's just the same, you know.
So did you have to learn how to cut hair to convincingly do the part?
A little bit, although I wouldn't trust me with doing your haircut now. I did a little bit of haircutting, but mostly it was funny. I came home. There were long hours. It was an independent film. I'd been working an 18-hour day one day, and I came home. It was we'd worked through the night. It was late on in the afternoon. I came home and one of my ex-wife's friend, my then-wife's friends, who was a gay man who was helping us decorate the house, was hanging some drapes. And when I came home, I lay on the couch. I was exhausted, and I went, "I am so tired of being gay." And it's funny. He turned and he looked at me and he said, "It can be work sometimes." And I thought that was it was so gracious and so funny. I do have this kind of great affection for the gay community. Because I was in the East Village, I was made very, very welcome there. And of course, it was just at the time that the AIDS thing was, a lot of these guys didn't make it through, you know, the first wave of this stuff. And it was a very kind of welcoming, very folksy, very homey environment. So that's why I used a gay character.
Another role that made you well-known before The Late Late Show was your role as Drew Carey's boss on The Drew Carey Show. How did you get that job? Were you already part of, like, the comedy circuit in America? Did Drew Carey know you from that?
No, not at all. Why? That was a very odd story. What happened was I was actually broke. I was down to my last 27 cents. I had 27 cents in the bank, which I don't know if you've ever tried to get 27 cents out of the bank. You can't do it. It costs a buck to take out 27 cents. It can't be done. So I was broke, and I had this manager at the time who got me this audition to play the part of the Hispanic photographer on the Brooke Shields sitcom Suddenly Susan. And I said, this is ridiculous. I looked at the script and I said, this part is for a Latino man. And he said, oh, you're foreign. Just go to the audition. And I had nothing else to do, so I went. And I went to the audition, and what happened was that, you know, I get to the corridor, and, you know, outside the audition, there's a bunch of guys who all look like Antonio Banderas sitting there, and we're, you know, they kind of look at me, I'm, you know, como estas, everybody, and I go in, and, you know, the producers laugh when I start talking, or even when they see me, about, you know, how inappropriate I am for the job. But one of the casting directors there was a guy called Tony Sepulveda from Warner Brothers Casting, and after the audition, he said, you're not really what we're looking for the Hispanic photographer, but we are doing a show with a guy from Cleveland. Can you do an English accent? And I said, sí, señor, I can. It was for auditioning for a job I was hopelessly wrong for. So it was a real lesson about showing up, even when you think it's ridiculous.
Craig Ferguson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me into your humble... No, it's not so humble, is it? Your very fancy studio.
Craig Ferguson hosts The Late Late Show on CBS. His new novel is called Between the Bridge and the River. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.